Anjali and the Incredible Kid. That is July 31st at Cathedral Park. More information at www.willametteriverfestival.org.
Somewhere between the Oscar Mayer Wienermobile and a Burning Man art cart.
You know, it brings joy.
Have you seen Cable's Fuzzy Boo van? From now until July 31st, we have a contest. If you spot the van anywhere around town, post a picture on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram with the hashtag FuzzyBoo. You will be entered to win a pair of passes to Music Fest Northwest. More information and contest terms can be found at kboo.fm/FuzzyBoo.
Here, inside, right? And then there's a little button on the dash here.
Yes!
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Nappy Farms, specializing in sustainable you-pick blueberry practices. Nappy Farms You-Pick Blueberries is located at 10280 Southeast Orient Drive in Boring, Oregon. For more information, the number is 503-663-0885 or online at nappyfarms.com.
From Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. As we continue our reporting from the Democratic National Convention brought to you by Truthdig and Free Speech TV, we'll examine social justice issues in the city that is hosting 50,000 outsiders. Ray Lewis, retired police captain in Philadelphia turned political activist, will discuss poverty, the election, police brutality, Black Lives Matter, and more. And we'll hear from Rebecca Hamill of the Fair Ride Philly Coalition about the sordid story of how Uber became legal in the city only 2 weeks before the DNC. Plus, Donna Smith, Executive Director of Progressive Democrats of America, will explain her group's inside-outside strategy of making change. She claims it's indeed working. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. I'm here at the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, where much, of course, is happening on the convention floor and in the caucus rooms and between delegates. But, of course, this convention is being held in the city of Philadelphia, a historic city, a very important city, and a city that has issues of its own. Joining me today is retired Philadelphia police Captain Ray Lewis. Welcome to the program, Mr. Lewis.
Thanks, Sonali, for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first of all, before we get into some of the issues that are important to you and your story, which is really fascinating, what do you make of the circus that has come into your town?
Well, it's like any other political circus. The media is only covering everything that's hunky-dory. They're not showing the thousands and thousands of people who are protesting outside.
On the one hand, you know, you have the history, you have the museums, you have the beautiful architecture, you have the wealth, but then you have the social ills that go along with many big cities, many diverse cities. You've got poverty, you've got struggles, you've got labor issues, you've got people, you know, demanding to be paid a bigger wage. And there's also a lot of grassroots activism here. How do you want, for example, the Democratic National Convention attendees, those who are new to Philadelphia, to view this city? Because other, you know, most people aren't stepping outside the perimeter of the Wells Fargo Center or this downtown city center. What would you like them to know about your city, the one that you presided over as police captain for many, many years, to see it in its fullness, good and bad?
Well, the one thing I think where Philadelphia is very unique in that they really have some very interesting, diverse neighborhoods. This is not a Houston or a Dallas, Miami. This has many different types of neighborhoods, founded some by the Italians, the Germans, the Irish, and they were different in structure, they're different in architecture. Although these people won't be able to see those neighborhoods, that to me is where Philadelphia really distinguishes itself. They're not going to see any of the problems in this city that affect every major city, and that is rich people pulled out, and they left the cities to disintegrate.
So, let's focus on that for a little bit. When you say the rich people pulled out, how has Philadelphia's economy suffered, and what impact has that had on low-wage workers? I know that around the country there's this Fight for 15 campaign, and Philadelphia workers have joined in with them, fast food workers, etc. How have people suffered from the poverty left behind by the bankers? But how are they fighting back?
Well, unfortunately, they can't fight back. They're disenfranchised. The only thing they can do is vote. That's the only power they have. And they don't feel that makes a damn, because they've done that and that doesn't work. If you want to see Philadelphia, what it really happened, we have an elevated train. We have train on the ground, we have underground train, but we also have an elevated train. Ride that from beginning to end and look out the window. You will see warehouse, factory after warehouse, after factory abandoned. All the way to the end. These once were factories that gave meaningful purpose and money and pensions and health care to workers in Philadelphia. That's when it was thriving. That's where I grew up. My father had a pension. My father had health care. All my neighbors, they had these kind of jobs. The rich people, and they are so rich, billionaires, but once you have billions of dollars and you want to make more money still, you're a sociopath. You don't care that your workers have health care. You don't care if that you pay them the minimum wage. And what they realized is, hey, if we take these union jobs down south where there were no unions, we can make maybe a million or two more in the next year to pad to our billions. Then they go down south and they realize with new technology, you know what? If we ship these jobs overseas, we can make another million. They don't care what happens to people. They have no heart. They're sociopaths. Sociopaths have no remorse, they feel no guilt, and they can always justify what they do. So taking away all these jobs, all these pensions, all this health care has destroyed every major city in America.
Including Philadelphia. So this, of course, is the most important, or I would say most commonly felt issue during this election year, and it is what has propelled the candidacies of Bernie Sanders, which of course now is no longer a candidacy. It's just on yesterday and on Tuesday the nomination of the Democratic Party formally went to Hillary Clinton, and of course the GOP has already picked Donald Trump, whose slogan is Make America Great Again, you know, which there's so many ways to parse that sentence and critique that sentence. However, both of the two candidates, Trump and Sanders, seem to have tapped into this deeply. Sanders, when he was a candidate, tapped into this deep-seated anger and disgust with our economic system. Now, of course, we're left with a choice between Trump and Hillary, a billionaire and a neoliberal economic politician. And both of them are making promises, but how do we believe them? Because, you know, ultimately, aren't Trump and Clinton both speaking for the 1% and not the 99%?
Absolutely. I don't even have to address Trump or Hillary, in my opinion, because they're nothing but the 1%. But I will quickly address Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders disappointed many of us when he joined the system by endorsing Hillary. I saw his acceptance speech. I was nauseous. The way he lauded. I'm sorry. His speech supporting Hillary Clinton. I could not believe he was raving about. If she was so wonderful, why didn't he support her from the very beginning? The man made a mockery. Bernie Sanders made a mockery of every single one of us, millions of people who supported him. People who broke their piggy banks, emptied their cookie jars to send him $5, $10, $15. People who stayed up into the wee hours of the morning creating signs, banners, puppets to march in hundreds of Bernie parades around the country because of this. He was offered the presidential nomination for the Green Party by Jill Stein. He declined it. He could have proved that he bowed to the people and not bowed to the system. When he declined that offer, he told me all I needed to know about him. He was not really outside this system. He's an inherent part of the system because he had it made. Number one, he would have got almost all of the independent vote, which is the biggest group of people, and it's growing. I mean, it's the most rapidly growing part of our electorate there is. Number two, he would have got all the people that were dissatisfied with Trump or Hillary. They would have went to him. The people who were abhorred the Democrats and Republicans who abhorred their nominees, he would have benefited from them by staying home. And he would have had an organization that is already on the ground and running, the Green Party. And he refused that. No time for him anymore either.
So then what? I mean, obviously, voting and elections are a very small part of how change happens, right? The least thing that you can do to change your country or to be participating in your political process is to go on election day and cast a ballot. It takes just a few minutes to do it. The most important work happens outside elections, right? How do you see that continuing? Do you see those people who supported Bernie Sanders giving up in disgust and saying, I'm going to go home and, you know, just go back to watching TV because nothing I do will make a difference? Or, as Sanders hopes and many others hopes, this idea of a political revolution continuing past the election?
No, most of Bernie Sanders' supporters are going to feel, I trusted this guy totally, and I was stabbed in the back again. Mm. Again. You're trusting somebody, a politician, and they turn on you. Bernie Sanders had first of all, there's half of this country is not registered to vote. He would have had millions of people going door to door to get people registered to vote. No other candidate in history had the grassroots excitement and enthusiasm that Bernie generated. He could have had 50% of this of these unregistered voters registered, because people would have hit the streets for him, just like they have been doing. And he blew it. He threw that grassroots power away. And so you're going to have a lot of people who say, you know, I sent him my money, I stayed up late, I did this, I did that. For what? For supporting Hillary Clinton? You got to be crazy.
Finally, Ray Lewis, I'm wondering what you hope or what sort of message you have, particularly for young people. You referred earlier to anybody under the age of 50 as being a kid to you. You're an interesting person with an interesting background, you know, a former police captain, now an activist. You sort of straddle different fields and intersect different fields. You have views that align with a lot of ordinary people, but not necessarily align with people in power. Can there be political change? Do you feel like in your lifetime we're going to see grassroots attempts like Occupy Wall Street, like Black Lives Matter, like, you know, many other efforts, climate justice activists, etc., start to make a positive difference in this country? And how do you keep from giving up?
Well, what keeps me from giving up, and I hope what keeps everyone from giving up, is what do we turn to? Do we just
fight or die?
Yeah, fight or die. I don't see us having an option to give up. But these type of things make it incredibly difficult to continue.
What period were you the police captain in Philadelphia, and when did you retire?
I was a police captain from 1999 to 2004. I started out as a patrol officer, as everyone does, and I spent 10 years in the belly of the beast before I made sergeant, lieutenant, and then captain. And I retired in 2004 and immediately went up to the Catskill Mountains with my wife, and we lived a very Walden-esque lifestyle. We raised a lot of organic food. We have chickens for eggs. I heated my home with wood from my own woodlands. And it was a very peaceful lifestyle. But then this thing called the Occupy movement came along. I realized these kids were exactly right in condemning our government and the corporations, and I decided I had to help them.
So after you retired as police captain, you had a small hiatus from busy life and then discovered you yourself were a political activist?
Well, it wasn't I guess you could say I discovered. I felt compelled because these kids were being disparaged. And, they weren't just kids. And by the way, I don't want to disparage them by calling them kids, but when you're my age, anybody under 50 is a kid, all right? But I saw what the media was doing to them. And you have to understand the media is owned by filthy, rich, white men who want to protect the status quo. They did not want white America to join in with this Occupy movement. So who did they interview at these protests? They interviewed the individuals with orange hair, with body piercings, with tattoos all over their body. I have nothing against any of that. I judge a person by their heart, by their actions. But mainstream media knew that white America, as soon as they saw these individuals, they would say, oh, that's not for me. I don't want to get involved in that Occupy movement, because they would not be able to relate to those people, some of those people involved in the Occupy movement. Mainstream media made it look like, hey, these are the people. You can't relate to them. Don't even think of joining this movement.
So you went down to the Occupy Wall Street encampment, and how did you lend your support?
Well, I lent my support basically by going up to the people and say, I'm here, use me in whatever fashion you want. I did not tell them this is what I'm going to do. This was their thing. I only appeared in a supportive role. And, well, what happened then is when somebody said, okay, you said it, we'd like you to come to a protest with us on Thursday morning. And I had got down there on Tuesday. I said, I'll be there. What time? He goes, 7. I said, 7 in the evening. No, 7 a.m. Hey, I've been retired for 8 years. I don't get up that early anymore. But anyway, hey, they wanted me up there at Wall Street at 7 a.m. I got there. I held a sign that said, NYPD, New York Police Department, don't be Wall Street mercenaries. In other words, they were protecting these banksters. And I went to that protest with that sign, and I was going to support them in uniform, because I know white America, if they see somebody in uniform protesting with the occupiers, it's going to give them some validity. Because there's nothing more that white America respects than a white male police officer, let alone a captain. So anyway, I go there with that in mind. And I had no anticipation at all of getting arrested. None whatsoever. The thought never entered my mind. But then I saw these young kids being dragged away one after the other, with their hands behind their back in these flexicuffs. And two things hit me right away, Sonalia. One is that these young people were willing to risk their freedom for who knows how long. They could have been put in jail for a day, a week, who knows, maybe a year. They did not know, but they were willing to risk that. Number two, what hit me was this protest happened just 3 days after the brutal destruction of Zuccotti Park by the NYPD. So they were also not only willing to risk their freedom, they were willing to risk their welfare, their physical welfare. They had no idea what would happen to them after they were taken out of view of the cameras. They could be brutally beaten. So these two things made me think, oh my gosh, they inspired me so much that I made the most spontaneous decision of my life. I put down my sign, I went out in the street, I sat down and I joined them in civil disobedience and not moving upon police command. I was then arrested for civil disobedience.
In full uniform?
In full uniform.
What impact did that have on you, and what, if any, possibly, on the police, on the NYPD?
The effect it had on me is documented in Time magazine and on in video. While walking across that intersection, handcuffed, I felt just so many cheers, so many people supporting me with their voices, and I actually physically had goosebumps. And I will say this today, I said it 5 years ago, walking across that intersection handcuffed was the proudest moment of my life. And I've had a lot of proud moments. The impact it had on NYPD and all police, whatever city I go to, the one word I always hear is traitor, 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 always. And if you know anything about warfare, armies hate a traitor more than the actual enemy.
So after Occupy Wall Street, how have you seen your role, particularly in the last couple of years, when the issue of police brutality has inspired what many are calling the next biggest social movement we've seen since Occupy Wall Street, and that's Black Lives Matter?
Yeah, well, I'm involved in a lot of different type protests, basically where any injustice, major injustice, is being forced on people. I was in Indianapolis fighting for gay rights. I fight against Monsanto poisoning our food. I fight against fracking and pipelines. I have joined BLM marches, but I am not, people, especially police, think I'm totally about fighting police brutality. I am fighting that, but that's not what all I'm about. That's where police see me as a bad guy.
Well, you are dressed as a police, you're wearing your police captain uniform. Where do you land on that sort of discussion and debate around the relationship between police and the community, not just in those violent flashpoints that are caught on camera, but even in general?
Well, what you have to consider with police brutality, a couple of things. Number one, you greatly reduce police brutality by decreasing street crime. You want to decrease street crime, fight poverty. You fight poverty by fighting the super filthy rich people in this country who oppress, discriminate, and exploit people. The second thing people have to realize about police brutality is, I'm going to give the other side, because it happened to me. I'll go right on record now. I've been on record already. I was a brutal cop. I hit people with my nightstick too many times, more than I had to. What people have to realize is that police profession is so different from any other profession. And what I mean by that is, more than any other profession, a police officer is confronting hostility. Everywhere from constantly fighting, you go to a disturbance house where a wife calls on the husband, you break up a fight in the street, people are always fighting you. One of the reasons why, by the way, is because 99% of the time, one of them or both are inebriated. They're drunk. And when you're drunk, you're going to be fighting police much more than if you're not. So that's one reason. By the way, I never fought anyone who was high on marijuana. I never had to. They never fought me. Taking drugs is an illness. It's an escape from reality. It's not a crime. You do not lock people up for having an illness that they need help. If we took that trillions of dollars and put it into addiction programs, if we put it into jobs, education, if we put it into counseling for these people that, hey, I don't have a purpose in life, I don't see a headway, hey, let's have free counseling for these people. Let's help them find purpose in life. The drug war has put so many good, productive citizens, potentially productive citizens, and productive. There's people in there that led productive lives, and they still were arrested. We have to change the whole paradigm there and start using that money for positive good and not for locking people up.
Ray Lewis, thank you so much for spending this time with me.
Thank you, Sonali. My pleasure.
This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. I'm here in the offices of Liberty Resources Incorporated, a center in downtown Philadelphia, and I'm with Rebecca Hamill, who works with the organization. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first, explain a little bit about Liberty Resources Incorporated and also the Philly Fair Ride Coalition that you're also, I understand, a part of.
So Liberty Resources is a center for independent living, which means we help individuals with disabilities to live independently in the community instead of in nursing homes. And this is, you know, one of the greatest civil rights issues facing disabled people now. We currently have legislation pending, the Disability Integration Act, that should make that a little easier, hopefully. So what the Philly Fair Ride Coalition consists of people with disabilities such as myself and also taxi drivers and limo drivers and Uber Black drivers right now. And what we're doing is we're fighting for worker protections and fair wages and accessible wheelchair-accessible vehicles for Philadelphians.
So I'm guessing that Philadelphia, like any big city in the United States, has challenges on the issue, or is challenged by the issue of transportation, who can access it, not just in terms of race and disability, economic class, geography, etc., right? So I'm guessing these are also longstanding bigger issues before companies like Uber came in?
Yeah, this has been a fight that's going on since before the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed 26 years ago. Here in Philly, I'm young. I haven't been working on these issues that long, but I do have the pleasure of working with some activists who've been on this issue for over 20 years, which kind of shows that it's a hard one. It's a hard one.
I'm from LA, and we struggle with those same.
Yeah, and it's not just it's not just a taxi and Uber issue. I mean, SEPTA, the Southeastern Pennsylvania Transportation Authority, which is our public transit system, the only aspect of that that's 100% accessible right now are the buses.
So here at the Democratic National Convention, Uber is a big presence. People, obviously the logistics are huge. It's the biggest convention, so the idea of having to move around tens of thousands of people between the city center, which is in downtown Philadelphia, and the Wells Fargo Center, where the actual convention is being held, quite a ways away. Those are big logistical problems, and Uber seems to have gotten a very sort of special dispensation from the city to have a presence at the convention. I rode in the back of an Uber car with a DNC volunteer and was shown this fancy Uber tent that's fully air conditioned, that was closer to the Wells Fargo Convention Center than any other place, for example, where the train let out. Free water bottles, free granola bars, fancy graphics. And clearly the DNC was very happy to have Uber there, and my guess is the city has given it permission. How did all of that happen? How did Uber get this Uber special treatment to be part of this convention that is, I'm sure, bringing in a lot of business?
Uber has actually only been legal in Philadelphia for the last couple weeks, which means that the DNC and Uber were probably making, or almost certainly making, deals,
How was it not legal before that?
So Philadelphia is kind of an exceptional city in the state of Pennsylvania. So Harrisburg, you know, our capital, they have more influence over us than they do over certain cities. So up until recently, Uber was actually legal throughout Pennsylvania, except for in Philadelphia County. But the taxi drivers have to pay extremely onerous fees, even though our Philadelphia Parking Authority actually did a study a couple of years ago that shows that they're all making well under minimum wage. They're averaging under $5 an hour, yet our parking authority continues to increase the fees on cab drivers. There was legislation on the table that would have made 100% of the cabs wheelchair accessible over the next several years as they were all replaced. You know, you'd have to replace them with a wheelchair accessible vehicle. But what happened was, you know, when Uber X started operating in Philadelphia, it really crushed our local taxi industry.
So that company coming in undermined the accessibility transition that the taxi drivers were involved in because it undercut the taxi revenues, and then they couldn't afford any longer to do the to outfit their cabs?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of the larger companies weren't thrilled about having another mandate, you know, another thing that they'd have to pay for. But, you know, we were working towards it, and we had won, I believe, 150 wheelchair accessible medallions that they were going to auction off over the course of a few years. Last summer, they auctioned off 51, I believe.
What do you mean by medallion?
Oh, sorry. I forget that not everyone's as obsessed with accessible transportation as I am. A medallion is literally like a little piece of metal that you can bolt to your cab's hood, and it means that you're a licensed cab that can operate in the county of Philadelphia. And those used to sell for almost $500,000. But now you can't give them away because our taxi industry is dying.
Okay, so then what did Uber's entry into or their attempt to take over the city of Philadelphia do to these issues?
Well, so it really put the disability issue on hold. You know, we know that Uber is, you know, really into union busting. So, you know, any attempts of our drivers, either, you know, Uber or, you know, traditional taxi to collectively bargain has been severely undercut.
So then just to back up, your colleagues and yourself are not just interested in issues of accessibility for users of these transportation companies, but also for fair wages for the workers in these companies, and you see those two issues as linked?
Well, absolutely. You know, we really believe that the issues of people with disabilities, as well as those who, the workers who provide the services that we depend on in order to operate independently in the community are, you know, forever intertwined. You know, our home care workers here are unionized. You know, we believe that people who, you know, are helping us out really do deserve some worker. We believe everyone deserves worker protections and a living wage. And I should also mention that the Philadelphia living, the cost of living here is very high. You know, it's not New York high, it's not San Francisco high, but it's not cheap either.
So then how did 2 weeks ago Uber manage to suddenly become legal, you know, 2 weeks ahead of the biggest convention that the city is going to see for a little while?
Well, that was a really weird story. So a couple of weeks ago, there was legislation pending in the State House, the Pennsylvania State House, that would have legalized and regulated transportation network companies in Philadelphia County. But the bill had about 200 amendments, including some that we had lobbied very hard to get on there, including a mandate for, you know, a certain percentage of accessible vehicles and, you know, fee, at least like an equivalent fee structure so that the taxis and the Uber drivers would be competing on a level playing field. You know, because Uber, you know, a lot of Philadelphia lives in poverty, 12% in deep poverty. And if you don't have a smartphone and a credit card, you can't use Uber. So, you know, even though Uber's here and it's not going away, there's still a place for a traditional taxi service. But anyway, so there was this bill pending, but they were, you know, getting ready to go on recess. And, you know, they said, you know, there's no way we could possibly sift through 200 amendments before our summer recess. So they tabled that bill until September. Then the Philadelphia Parking Authority went behind closed doors with Uber and made a backroom deal. A secret backroom deal. The deal itself wasn't secret. The contents of the deal are secret. But what it means, they basically agreed to not take any enforcement steps against Uber from now until September 30th. And also, Uber owed over $1 billion in fines for operating illegally.
Over $1 billion in fines?
Not a billion, just a million.
Oh, a million. But here in Philadelphia alone?
Philadelphia alone, they owed over $1 million in fines. And the parking authority settled with them for $350,000. Oh. So we went to court because the Philadelphia Parking Authority is a public regulatory agency. They're not supposed to make backroom deals. They're supposed to be...
Those are tax revenues that they gave away, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. So as opposed to, like, you know, taking hundreds of dollars a month like they do for cab drivers, they're taking 1% of revenues, of which 2/3 are going to the school district and 1/3 is going to the PPA. Wow. So we went to court, and the judge we got actually agreed with us that this deal was not legal under the current, you know, charters that allow these agencies to operate. So we won a temporary restraining order. A couple of our members, you know, had filed a suit. And then that very evening, we found out that there had been language snuck into a state Senate appropriations bill giving the parking authority the authority to make deals like that without regulatory oversight. So it was just like, it was just so specific.
So basically, your elected officials went out of their way to ensure that Uber got this special treatment. Why is this happening? Do Uber lobbyists essentially pressure politicians? Are they spending money at the political level to make these sorts of things happen?
You know, I'm not going to say for sure one way or the other, but I do know that let's say I'm not going to say they're, you know, doing anything illegal,
right, yeah.
But, you know, this is a company that's valued at almost $70 billion. And a lot of that money they're using to lobby and to fight lawsuits, because this isn't the only city where people are saying, you know, this is a cool technology, but maybe we shouldn't leave, you know, drivers' rights and people with disabilities and, you know, the ability of people who are poor to get a ride behind.
So the DNC could be for local businesses is a huge bonanza, of course, a huge infusion of outside cash. That's how cities sell these kinds of conventions, of course, if you will, to the public, that it's going to spur the local economy. Because of what happened with Uber, are local taxi companies basically not going to see very much of that economic stimulus because Uber is able to undercut them so much? I mean, everywhere I go, people are like, oh, take an Uber. It's so cheap. It's so cheap. Take an Uber.
Yeah. And let me say that the expensive taxi rates, those are actually set by the Philadelphia Parking Authority. Our taxi drivers don't set those rates. Those are the mandated.
That's a really good point.
Citywide rate. So, you know, let's say, like, it's definitely cut. They're sure it's cut in. The people I've talked to all say it's cut into their revenue. But they also say that this is, you know, possibly the only time this summer that they'll actually have a chance to turn a profit. So, you know, our drivers are out there, you know, really working hard.
So essentially, the long term view, then, what happens when you have a company like Uber with so much preferential treatment by local government authorities and taxi companies losing business as a result, when the rates are set by your authority, what I can imagine is going to happen is that little by little, people who are working in the regulated taxi industry are going to end up moving into Uber, which is going to basically transform your transportation industry into an unregulated, the sort of so-called gig economy, so-called sharing economy model, where where once they might have been making union wages, they're going to be making below even minimum wages? I mean, is that what you feel is a long-term trend?
I feel like that's the long-term trend nationwide. Here in Philadelphia, our taxi industry was actually deunionized in the early 90s. So our taxi drivers were struggling long before Uber came into the scene. But Uber coming onto the scene is not helping. And I don't know if to call it preferential treatment, but just like the parking authority has turned their head away from, you know, Uber's multiple transgressions while continuing to regulate the taxi industry very heavily. And that doesn't make sense to me.
So if the transportation authority is setting the rates for taxi companies, what are the wages of drivers based on? I mean, obviously, they must have to be paid the minimum wage. Not just Uber drivers. I'm talking about taxi drivers.
Yeah, I'm saying taxi drivers are also make sub-minimum wage here in Philadelphia. So a lot of them, they pay licensing fees for their, for their hack license. They pay, a lot of them took out loans to get their medallions back when the medallions were worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Some of them have car loans. A lot of them are, driving for companies that are larger medallion holders, but still treats them as an independent contractor. So they pay fees to those companies for the privilege of driving one of their cabs.
So in the end, even they end up being paid sub-minimum wages.
Correct.
So.
Yeah, and, it's just, a public transit system is something that, a city needs. Everyone benefits from good public transportation. And right now, our only public transportation workers who are unionized are the SEPTA drivers. The paratransit drivers are not unionized. Those are the buses that are specifically for people with disabilities. Yeah, they don't make good money, but they still make more than taxi drivers right now.
So what would you say to convention goers, delegates, journalists, the press, et cetera, who are here in Philadelphia? Some people like to think we can affect change by voting with your dollars. But we're coming and going within the span of a week. Is there a short-term recommendation and a long-term recommendation that you can make for people who are interested in social justice issues like this?
My short-term recommendation would be to tip your Uber driver if you do take an Uber or a Lyft. Tip them cash. There's no place on the app for a tip. That's something that Uber drivers are fighting for in some places. But, remember...
They like the idea of having a cashless transaction, right?
Exactly. But, remember that of that cashless transaction, of, that really cheap fare, 25% is going to Uber. And a lot of these drivers also, you've got your normal car expenses. And then a lot of them also have subprime loans on their vehicles taken out that Uber helped facilitate.
So Uber's a bank, a lending institution as well.
Uber is taking over the world. Their end game is self-driving autonomous vehicles to cut the driver out entirely.
So if you're going to take an Uber, tip them generously with cash, or possibly even if you're taking a taxi ride, do the same.
Oh, absolutely. Anyone who's driving you, unless they're a SEPTA driver, tip them well, please. That's the short term. Support labor, because labor unions are, one of our only, one of the only things that could possibly stand up to Uber at this point. But,
are there national efforts that you know of around Uber, or are the fights all sort of localized like the one here?
I think it's largely localized, but that's a lot of, what union organizing is, just one bargaining unit in one shop at a time. So we have a couple examples where Uber drivers have banded together and are, getting more rights, but not necessarily, all the rights they need. But we can look at what's going on in New York with the Drivers Guild. We can look at what's happening in, I believe, Seattle. There was recently a court victory. I can't believe that the Democratic Party would partner with Uber, but they're they have so many lawsuits against them right now for violation of workers' rights, you know.
And for all the lip service being paid to labor unions and economic rights and equitable wages, the DNC has partnered with a company that stands against all of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, they assume that they will have the vote of the disability community, which they probably will, because, you know, unlike Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton has not made fun of any reporters with disabilities on air. So, but, you know, I think that bar is set a little too low. I think we should not just be looking for the party that doesn't make fun of disabled people and the one, you know, and, you know, it's great that they just included the Disability Integration Act on their platform, and for that we're thrilled. But, you know, I still think that partnering with Uber was not a great move.
Well, Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and helping us understand the story of Uber and the DNC. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was absolutely a pleasure talking to you.
Rebecca Hamill is my guest. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Reporting for Free Speech TV and Truth Dig, this is Sonali Kohatkar. It's day three of the Democratic National Convention, and I'm here with Donna Smith. She is the executive director of the Progressive Democrats of America. We're on the third floor of the Marriott Hotel, where a press conference has just taken place of the Bernie Delegates Network. Donna, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So first, can you, just for those people who are not familiar with it, explain what Progressive Democrats of America is and how it is related to the sort of network of Bernie delegates?
Absolutely. Progressive Democrats of America is a federal PAC. Our mission is to support progressive candidates and advance them in congressional races and other races. About 2.5 years ago, we started circulating a petition to ask Bernie Sanders to run as a Democrat. We thought we would give it to him if we got 10,000 signatures, and we got many, many more thousands of signatures than that. On the 14th of May of 2014, we gave those signatures to Bernie Sanders. He did not make the decision at that point. He would have lots more people trying to influence and work on him. So we launched into what we called our We Want Bernie campaign. The only presidential candidate we have ever endorsed as an organization is Bernie Sanders, and that's because we're an issue-based organization, and he lined up on every issue that we are very concerned about. So for the last 2.5 years, we've been full-out Bernie Sanders supporters and really working very hard throughout the country in various chapters to support his work.
So basically, PDA has been one of those organizations that has attempted to push the party from the inside as sharply to the left as you possibly can, and to recruit Sanders was a big prong or a big sort of, was that, how big of a shift in your strategy was that if he was the first candidate you've ever endorsed?
A big shift, and I think our congressional candidates have felt that this time around, and that usually we would spend the summer really working on those down ballot congressional races, and our attention has been so fully supportive of Bernie. We have fielded more than 220 Bernie delegates from throughout PDA's membership throughout the country. We were even a little surprised at how many of the Bernie delegates were PDA members. We're thrilled and pleased, but that has focused our work almost entirely through the primary season on being in those primary states, assisting wherever we needed to, whether it was canvassing, phone banking. We made tens of thousands of phone calls by volunteers making those calls to really to get the message out around Sanders. And really, in our network, it wasn't that difficult because he was so clear on the issues and so clearly aligned with us. That was a real pleasure. So it was really about putting the bodies and the energy and the passion to it.
Now, did that end up making the down-ballot candidates suffer and those campaigns suffer?
I think a little bit, yes. So we're a little bit behind the eight ball at this point in terms of giving them the support that we normally do. So as soon as this convention is over, I think next week will be the week when we really retool a little bit and get ready for the campaign that will be in the fall season. People have asked us if we're going to endorse Hillary Clinton. In reality, we will not. That does not mean we'll be working against her. But the reality, because if we line up Donald Trump and say, does he align with our issues? That's absolutely not true. So we're going to put our energy really into those down ballot races and those people who do align with PDA's issues.
And Sanders himself has actually lent his name to a lot of the down ballot candidates around the country, which maybe has given them a boost.
It has. And we're really pleased when we see a message come out from the Bernie campaign supporting one of those candidates, because they really benefit from his support. His endorsement means so much to people, and that he's looked carefully and honestly at where they stand and believes that they would be a good public servant, and that means a lot.
Now, on the flip side, how has the Sanders campaign energized PDA?
Wow. I mean, here we have this. I think the most exciting way it's energized it so far is that we see that previously we would look at a room of PDA supporters and you'd see a lot of people in my age group, you know, a lot of gray hair, a lot of grandmas and grandpas, and a lot of people who are in kind of that aging hippie range, and all too frequently way too white. And as we watched the Sanders campaign proceed through the last 2.5 years, what was really fascinating was to look at how diverse the rooms began to be, and very exciting. We would see all age ranges. We began to see cultural diversity, and we saw it in a way that was exciting. And now going forward, we got a contact from some young students who've been organizing for Bernie Sanders on college students all across the country. They want to partner with another organization, with PDA, and help start reforming those Bernie chapters on college campuses into real political engines for those students on those campuses. That is extremely exciting work, to see young people and millennials who will be now interested, engaged, and they lend a special kind of energy and intelligence that we aging hippies really don't.
Now the two-party system has really been built less on real issues that matter and more on, you know, getting Wall Street's candidates, if you will, into the White House. What are the issues that define PDA and the issues that you want to see addressed by whoever is in the White House?
Well, I think the climate emergency is clearly one of the biggest issues, and we were very proud to see that we had an amendment introduced through the platform committee by Russell Green, one of the PDA Bernie delegates from California, a wonderful sweeping climate mobilization amendment that passed, thank goodness, that went through. It was a little bit tweaked in the process. We thought the tweaking might have been a little bit more than we would be comfortable with, but basically it was retained in the platform. Single-payer health care and Medicare for All is a critical issue to our activists. We've been working on it for a very long time, lessening the commitment to a military standing in this world and being more about peace and justice. Racial justice is a big issue for our groups. ERA, the ERA, an interesting